Taxes! Down with taxes! Down with taxes!
You think of the children!
Are these morons getting dumber or just louder?
Dumber, sir. They won't give up the bear patrol, but they won't pay taxes for it either.
Ducking this issue calls for real leadership. People, your taxes are high because of illegal immigrants. That's right, illegal immigrants. We need to get rid of them.
Immigrants, I knew it was them. Even when it was the bears, I knew it was them.
In 1 week, the town will vote on a special referendum whether or not to deport all illegal immigrants from Springfield. It shall be known as Proposition 24. Yeah.
In 1807, farmer, writer, and politician William Cobbett described how, as a boy, he would use a smoked fish that had a strong scent to throw hunting dogs from the trail of a rabbit. A couple of decades later, the story was published and hence the popular term red herring was born, a metaphor to describe a method of distracting an audience or listener and drawing their attention away from relevant and salient facts. This is exactly what this classic clip from The Simpsons perfectly illustrates and what many of us have become used to seeing, especially in politics. The duck and dodge, the diversion, the red herring thrown so that we waste our time, energy, and effort on issues that are irrelevant to the core of the matter. You know where else you see this a lot? In wrongful conviction cases. That's because it is nearly impossible to convict an innocent person unless the investigation itself went off the rails. In every single case we've ever covered on the show, you see it. Detectives following irrelevant witnesses, evidence that doesn't exist, theories that make no sense in order to nail their suspect. 2 years ago in the Greg Land series, we reported on one of the most inane red herrings in a case that I'd ever seen, the Heron Farm. In order to fit the suspect to their theory, the lead investigator in that case decided that the defendant had done target practice at a place called the Heron Farm, and that he had later disposed of evidence there. Never mind that Greg Lance's movements were accounted for the entire time the police alleged that he was at the farm, and that Greg Lance would have had to shatter the laws of time and space to make their theory work. That was what they stuck with. And because they stuck with it, they spent countless hours building on the theory, and it took countless hours for us to dismantle it, because we couldn't just not address the issue. It was a huge, fat waste of time and energy on an irrelevant distraction, the mother of red herrings, as I like to call it. Again, it's almost always the case that red herrings lead to wrongful convictions, and like in Greg Lance's case, the red herrings often come from investigators themselves. In our present case, though, the red herrings were being doled out by the prime suspect. But he wasn't doing a very good job. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 4 of the series The State vs. Jason Carroll. My name is Robbie Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In our second addendum episode, investigator Sarah Cowan said something that perfectly illustrates what Ken was doing in the days and weeks after Sharon's murder, frantically mopping up his muddy footprints, only to end up creating others, some of which he wasn't even aware he was leaving. Like his comment over the phone on the day he was told of Sharon's murder, in which he was overheard saying that her body was found nude when he hadn't been told anything about the condition of her body. Big muddy footprint. Then came the strong box, which he not only mentioned to investigators, but actually showed to Trooper Thomas Sexton. A box that, according to Melanie, only had two keys, and both keys were stored in Sharon's wallet, which had never been recovered from the crime scene. A few days after Melanie told the police this, they received a call from a confidential informant who, halfway down the page, was clearly identified as Sharon's father, Harold Eaton. Mr. Eaton asked to meet with investigators and told them emphatically that Sharon was the only person to have the strongbox key and that she kept it in her purse. How, asked Mr. Eaton, was Ken able to open the strongbox then? He also confirmed that there was a second mortgage in the house, as Ken had mentioned, but added that this mortgage was taken to clear Ken's gambling debts. Most importantly, Mr. Eaton gave the police their first real break on a motive in the case. So far, while they suspected Ken, they hadn't uncovered a history of violence or a possible affair. Sharon was the primary breadwinner of the family too, so again, why would he want her dead? Well, said Mr. Eaton, Sharon had a pension fund worth tens of thousands of dollars, and just a few weeks before her death, she told her family she was planning on withdrawing that money to pay off the second mortgage. Mr. Eaton had no idea if she'd ever gotten that money or not. It wasn't the first time that investigators had heard of the fund, but it was the first time they'd been told that Sharon was planning on withdrawing the money. A week before Mr. Eaton told police this, Lucy Holt had already informed them about the fund, and it turned out the Holtz may have been responsible for Ken learning about it. Lucy Holt's 1988 statement noted that Ken's eyes were watery and red, as if he was high or drunk, even though it was 8 a.m. Ken sat up at attention when the fund was mentioned and immediately began haranguing Sharon to withdraw the money.
He was sitting at the kitchen table. I can see this like a movie. I've got my eyes closed and I can see it like a movie. She was standing to my right with my husband. And my husband said something about moving money from an IRA, that they work at the same place, et cetera. And she said something about it. And Ken said, what do you mean? You've got money? And she looked very nervous and tried to change the subject. But he brought it up and said, well, you don't put it into something else. He says, you just take it. Just take the money so we can use it. Just take it. You don't need to move it someplace. Let's just take it. So wow. He wanted that money.
Robert Holt, Lucy's husband, tried to explain to Ken that withdrawing the money early meant losing about 40% of the fund money in taxes and penalties. Sharon agreed with Robert and said she wanted to keep the money in the account.
It seems that Sharon changed her mind, perhaps because Ken pressured her to, because she told her family shortly thereafter that she was withdrawing her pension fund. Digital Corporation confirmed to the police that just 3 weeks prior to her murder, Sharon Johnson had applied to withdraw her pension fund, but was murdered before the money was transferred to her. The sole beneficiary of that fund was her husband, Ken Johnson. Ken would get the funds, which were a little over $50,000, if he submitted her death certificate. Digital also confirmed that Sharon had a total of $82,000 in life insurance benefits, with 75% of that allotted to Ken and 25% to her daughter Melanie. In total, Ken stood to receive $111,000 because of Sharon's death, not to mention the house and any other assets. Financial motives aren't uncommon in murders, and in this case, the police also knew that Ken had a history of gambling issues, making the insurance and pension proceeds even more salient. What they didn't know was whether Ken was in any debt currently, but Ken was about to reveal his hand on that front without meaning to, and create some more muddy footprints.
Ken had already admitted to Mary Lou Farah and her boyfriend Buddy Beaulieu that he was worried that the police were looking closely at him, and he decided his best course of action would be to put them on someone else's trail. Which may have been why, 6 days after the murder, he made a call to the Bedford police and asked to speak to a detective. Detective David Davidson, who had been one of the officers to notify Ken and the family of Sharon's murder, got on the line. Ken seemed intoxicated to him, slurring his words as he spoke slowly. He had a lead for the investigators, the first time in the record that Ken appears to care at all about trying to find who killed Sharon. Ken had information he thought may be relevant to the case. His daughter Melanie had just informed him that she had, quote, friends hanging out in Bedford because they think they killed somebody. Ken then told Davison to call Melanie for more information. 4 hours later, Ken called back again and asked if the police had called Melanie, who was at her father's house, and gotten any new information. He asked the officer who answered the phone to call him back with anything they learned. Davison had in fact already called Melanie and asked who had told her they were involved in killing someone. Melanie first refused to give the officer any information, but after Davison insisted, she finally relented and gave him a name, Renee Lamper. 14-year-old Renee, a friend of Melanie's, came into the Bedford police station with her mother after being summoned there, and Davison asked her if what Ken had said was true, that she knew people who had killed someone in Bedford. Renee responded that she never said anything of the sort, but she had told Melanie that she knew a lot of people in Manchester and maybe could play detective and find something out from them. Renee turned out to be a dead end, but Ken's bigger play at trying to throw the police off his scent was yet to come.
Do you remember anything about this supposed character named Bob that Sharon was supposed to meet that night?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay.
You have a last name?
Okay. Do you remember her? Did they have a realtor? Who was showing them the properties?
That I don't know. That I have no clue. Again, I was too young. No clue.
Okay.
I was only 14 years old. I mean, I had just barely turned 14. My birthday was in May. My mom died in July.
Yeah, and also this is 30-odd years. Yeah. Ever heard any mention of a person named Bob?
I want to say that sounds familiar, but I for what reason I would have known that name, I don't know.
Okay.
Did Sharon ever talk to you about a Bob? We don't have a last name, just a Bob that was apparently connected to Ken's gambling issues.
No, I don't remember that.
As investigators tried to piece together Sharon's movements on the night she was killed, they eventually confirmed that Sharon had made it to the Tingsboro convenience store to play the lottery, but it took a number of weeks before they were able to do so. Before they got that confirmation, however, Ken told the police that he just knew for sure that Sharon went to the lottery place that night, because she had a $40 winning ticket to cash in, and they needed the money. They needed the money so badly, he added, that they had been considering asking her parents for a loan. Of course, the fact that they needed money wasn't evidence of her actually having made it to the store. After all, Sharon could have been intercepted before she reached Tingsboro. Ken, however, seemed pretty certain of it. There was another lead that the police had gotten, though, that Ken wasn't so certain of. Just a few days after Sharon was killed, police interviewed another one of Sharon's very close friends and co-workers, this time a woman named Sharon Ross. Ross told the police that for a number of weeks, Sharon Johnson had been attempting to reach a man named Bob. Bob was an associate of Ken's, or maybe he worked for Ken, and he owed Ken $4,000. Bob was apparently going through a divorce and liquidating his property, and Sharon Johnson had told Sharon Ross that Bob was trying to work out some kind of deal with one of his properties to pay off the debt that he owed to Ken. This tracked with another statement by a friend of Sharon's named Louis Lavoie, who had earlier told the police that Sharon had been looking to buy a home in the Bedford-Merrimack area, and that Sharon had told her Ken had friends that could get them a good deal in the area. This potential deal with Bob might have been what Sharon was talking about with Louise. Sharon Ross had even more important information, though. She told the police that Sharon Johnson was supposed to meet Bob on the evening of Thursday, July 28, 1988, the night she was murdered. A week later, in the same interview in which Ken told the police that he was certain that his wife went to the lottery place, Detective Roger Grenier asked Ken about the Bob that owed Ken and Sharon $4,000. Ken responded that the only Bob he knew was Bob Holt, the husband of Lucy Holt, the couple that had inadvertently told Ken about Sharon's thrift fund. The Holts were good friends, he said, and they didn't owe the Johnsons any money. 2 days later, when Trooper Thomas Sexton dropped in on Ken and found him writing thank you cards with Kathy Hampson, he brought up Bob again. Did Ken know anyone that could fit the description his wife had given to Sharon Ross, a man named Bob that owed them $4,000? This time Ken responded that he didn't know anyone named Bob, much less a Bob that owed them any money. And that's when Trooper Sexton let Ken in on the source of this information, that Sharon's co-worker said that Sharon was going to be meeting Bob, the man that owed them $4,000, on the very night she was killed. Ken thought for a moment and suddenly remembered that he did know a Bob Stengel, a co-worker of Sharon's. You might remember we heard from the Stengels in both episode 2 and 3. Mr. Stengel had been a friend of Sharon's who called the police to tell them about how strange Ken had acted when they had gone over with other friends to see him on the Saturday morning after the murder. Ken told Trooper Sexton that the Stengels didn't owe them any money, though. And in fact, the year prior, the Johnsons had borrowed $1,500 from the Stengels for Ken's back surgery, a loan that had already been paid back. There was, according to Ken, no Bob that owed them any money at all.
At least that was the story until the next day, when Trooper Sexton got a call from Ken's lawyer, attorney Peter Leahy, who told the officer that his client wanted to come clean. Ken had lied to Sexton about his gambling issues and wanted to meet again. They agreed to meet at Ken's house the next day, and when Trooper Sexton arrived, he found Ken sitting at his kitchen table with his attorney next to him. Ken was calm, but told Sexton he was upset with him. He didn't like that Sexton had asked him questions about gambling in front of Kathy Hampson, and reprimanded him. If Sexton was going to question him about the case, he should have sent Kathy out of the room at least. Ken was embarrassed in front of Kathy and felt forced to lie. Now, however, Ken was ready to tell the truth. He burst into tears and admitted there was in fact a man named Bob who owed Ken $7,000. As he sobbed, he said, quote, "If she died because of this, I won't be able to live." Sexton watched as Ken wept for the next few minutes and repeated similar things, that if the gambling debt was the cause of Sharon's death, it was all his fault. Once Ken finally calmed down, he told Sexton that Bob placed bets of between $500 to $1,000 a week on sports games directly with Ken, who in turn placed those bets with a bookie named Craig Maxfield. Ken got a $100 commission for placing the bets, which is why he did it for Bob. Ken doesn't explain, however, why Bob just didn't place the bets himself. Bob was now in debt to Ken for $7,000, $1,000 of which was Ken's commission. The rest was money, $6,000, which was what Ken now owed to Craig Maxfield. So far, Ken had paid Maxfield $800, but he still owed him $5,200. Bob had a Polish last name, Ken told Sexton, but he couldn't remember it. Ken also couldn't remember Bob's phone number. Sexton found this weird because Ken otherwise knew the number of every person they ever talked about by heart, including the numbers of Sharon's many friends. Not to worry, said Ken. He had a gambling book. Maybe that would have the number in it. Ken and his attorney went looking for the book and returned with a ledger. Unfortunately, it turned out the gambling book made no mention of Bob. Sexton then began pressing Ken for more details about Bob, hoping to get enough information so they could identify the man that Sharon was planning on meeting after work. Where did they meet? What did Bob look like? What did he do? Sexton asked Ken all these questions. Ken had met Bob at a restaurant called The Backroom in Manchester. He had brown hair, was around 6 feet tall and slender, had a mustache, and didn't wear glasses. Bob drove a white car, a Pontiac Fiero or Toyota MR2, and worked in marketing as a consultant or something, said Ken. Ken said that he hadn't seen or spoken to Bob in 8 months, but then, a few minutes later, stated that Bob called him periodically and had last called 5 or 6 weeks ago. They were even supposed to meet up at the Sheridan Wayfair in Bedford 2 or 3 weeks ago, but Bob never showed up. Bob didn't know Sharon, hadn't ever met her, but knew where she worked, and Sharon knew that Bob owed Ken $7,000. Ken didn't mention anything about plans that Sharon and Bob had to meet up, and wasn't able to offer Sexton any more information about how they could find this Bob. Ken could tell Sexton about Craig Maxfield, the bookie, however. Craig was around 36 years old and worked in sheetrock taping. Craig and Ken bowled together up until that past April, and he last saw Craig at the Belmont track. Craig asked him for the money that he was owed, but Ken didn't have any. Ken hadn't heard from or seen Craig since. It was like Craig had disappeared. Ken had called Craig's girlfriend, but she also had no idea where Craig was. Ken recited off Craig's girlfriend's number to Sexton from memory. During the interview, Sexton noticed a keyring sitting on the kitchen counter and asked if he could see the key that Ken had used to open the strongbox. The keyring had four rings on it, and Ken explained each one. A house key, a key to the strongbox, a Hudson key which seemed to be the kind to fit in a file cabinet, and a U.S. Postal Service P.O. Box key. Ken couldn't remember what the Hudson key was for, and offered it to Sexton if he wanted to take it, but Sexton refused. The P.O. Box key, however, piqued his interest.
Two days later, Ken was summoned to the state police laboratory to get fingerprinted, which turned out to be harder than you'd expect. Ken's eyes were glassy and he smelled of alcohol. He didn't seem drunk, but he had certainly been drinking. Ken refused to relax his hand and kept moving his fingers as the technician tried to take the prints. The first print card had to be discarded, and they tried again. Again, though, Ken moved his fingers, smudging the prints. As they continued to attempt to get clear prints from Ken, Corporal Timothy Pickle took the opportunity to ask him some questions. First, he showed him a picture of a man and asked if he knew him. Ken stared at the picture and then responded that he did not. He asked the officer if he knew who it was, and the officer responded he had no idea. Then Ken asked a question that indicated he knew about the witness that saw a pregnant woman being pressed against a car at the mall the night of the murder. He asked, "Is this the man from Auto Road?" It's not clear how Ken knew about Auto Road, which was where Margaret O'Brien had seen the couple, but it's unlikely that the media would have learned about this detail, which means one of the investigators must have told Ken or told another family member, who then told Ken. Either way, it's strange that the police would have told anyone about the incident rather than hold it close to their chest as they tried to identify who Margaret had seen. Regardless, Officer Pickle told Ken no, it wasn't the man from Auto Road. It was a picture that had been taken at Sharon's funeral. "Are you lying to me?" Ken said, and got visibly upset about the strange man at the funeral. As the fingerprint tech struggled with Ken's stiff fingers, Pickle asked him to tell him everything he could about Bob. This time, just a few days since Ken first admitted to the existence of Bob and having first met at the backroom restaurant, Ken told Pickle that he had initially met Bob at a Sheraton Wayfair. "How was it," asked Pickle, "that Bob had come to owe him $7,000? Ken Johnson gave him a different answer than he had given to Sexton. He told Pickle that he placed job bids to Craig Maxfield from Bob, and that Bob had not paid him. Pickle wasn't sure if he was understanding correctly because he knew about the prior statement, so he asked Ken to clarify. Again, Ken told him the money was for construction bids, and didn't mention gambling at all. Finally, the fingerprint tech asked to take yet another fingerprint card because she couldn't get a clear one. Every finger was difficult to print, according to the report. Pickle asked Ken once again to relax his hand, and Ken responded, "It's difficult because you are accusing me with that photograph." It's not clear what Ken meant by that. Maybe that the photograph was someone Ken knew but was hiding? Perhaps someone who could implicate Ken? Pickle was likely hoping that this strange man in the picture was the Bob that they'd been trying to identify. But he clearly wasn't. And Ken's wildly different answers about Bob just deepened the mystery of Bob.
The next time that Bob emerges in the record is a week after the near-failed fingerprint attempt, when a friend of Sharon's named Connie Lefebvre called the police to tell them something. She reported that Ken had told her that a man named Bob owed the Johnsons money, that Ken hadn't seen the man in 7 weeks, and that it was someone that Sharon had never met. Ken also described Bob to Connie. She was around 5'7" tall, with dirty blonde hair, Ken told her. Now, if you're keeping track, that's two completely different descriptions of Bob the police now have. He's either 6 foot tall or 5'7" tall, and he either has brown hair or dirty blonde hair. The hunt for Bob was on, and the police made sure to begin checking in with people in Sharon's circle to see if any of them knew any information about this potential suspect. Kenneth Eaton, Sharon's brother, attempted to press Ken Johnson for more information about Bob, and then reported back to the police. According to Ken, he hadn't seen Bob in weeks, and was looking for him to get the money that he was owed. Ken told Eaton that Bob was around the same height as Ken, and was known to hang out at the Wayfarer Bar. This was an odd detail, because just days earlier, Connie Lefebvre had told the police that Ken asked if she wanted to meet him for drinks at the Wayfarer, but she had declined. If the story about Bob was kind of strange until now, it was only going to get weirder when Ken once again, through his attorney, demanded to meet with Trooper Sexton to tell him, quote, things that he failed to tell Sexton before.
Trooper Sexton arrived at the Johnson house the same day he got the call, on August 23rd, now nearly a month after the murder, and found Ken pacing on his deck. His attorney hadn't arrived yet, and Sexton, always one to do things by the book, told him that they should wait for Leahy to get there. Instead, Ken handed Sexton a key and told him that Bob had given him the key and that it belonged to a house in Merrimack that was under construction. Bob was a part-time real estate agent, said Ken, and he was going to give them a deal on a house to compensate for the money that he owed Ken. Bob had already showed them the house twice, according to Ken. First, he'd taken Ken to the house alone, and then he had taken Ken and Sharon to the house together to see it. But they hadn't finalized the deal between them fast enough, and the house got sold elsewhere. Then Ken went on to tell Sexton that Bob had called him at home on Wednesday, July 27th, the day before Sharon was killed. They talked about the money that Bob owed Ken, and that was when Bob told Ken to meet him the next day, on the 28th. Bob promised to get Ken a deal on a set of French doors in a Manchester store called Grossman's. If that sounds familiar, it's because that's the store that Ken said he visited the night of the murder to buy a construction level, but then he never went inside. Ken was supposed to meet Bob at either Grossman's or at the Sheraton Wayfarer Hotel in Bedford between 7:15 and 7:30 p.m. on that night. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's not only because it's a historic hotel, but also because the restaurant at the hotel, which was called the Wayfarer, was in fact one of the locations that Ken had earlier mentioned having first met Bob at. According to Ken, when he got to Grossman's, he didn't see Bob's car, so he went to the Sheraton and parked at the parking lot adjacent to the Sheraton in the Bedford Mall parking lot, around 7:45 p.m. When Bob's car never showed up, Ken left, he said. He got as far as Goffstown, then turned around and went to Manchester to get cigarettes from the Amskig Market. After that, he drove straight home and arrived home between 9:30 and 10 p.m. Sharon was not supposed to meet Bob that night, said Ken. Only he was going to meet him. Ken didn't want to tell Sharon about the deal on the French doors until it was, quote, solid. Trooper Sexton pressed Ken further about the night Sharon was murdered. Had he gone to the CVS in the mall, like he said, to buy greeting cards? No, admitted Ken. He lied about it. Why did you lie about that? Asked Sexton. Ken responded, quote, I didn't think I was involved with that night. I didn't think me and Bob were involved. I know I am now. We will never know what that word salad meant, but Sexton then asked Ken to tell him everything he knew about Bob, and Ken complied. He said he had not heard from Bob for 5 or 6 weeks until that phone call the day before Sharon's murder. Bob's car had Massachusetts plates on it, and they had first met at the Backroom restaurant in Manchester in September of 1987, nearly a year earlier. In December of 1987, Bob started placing bets through Ken. Bob bet $1,000 every night of the week, said Ken, losing $7,000 in a week. Ken only ever gambled with Bob's bet and had only once placed a $50 bet of his own money. Strangely enough, none of these bets were recorded in the gambling ledger he'd produced earlier, and no, he also didn't have another book where he recorded any of it. Ken had met with Bob at various locations since December, he told Sexton, including at the Sheraton Wayfarer, the Backroom Bar, a Holiday Inn, and a Hannah Jack's Tavern. Bob was divorced and liked mixed drinks, and at least on three occasions, Ken and Sharon were supposed to meet Bob for a double date, but Bob never showed. Ken then described Bob. He was about 30 years old, between 5'10 and 5 feet 11 inches tall, weighed around 180 pounds, had a trimmed mustache, no beard, no glasses, and wore his brown hair swept back. Bob looked smooth, said Ken. Ken offered to assist in creating a composite image. After all, he wanted to help the police find Bob. But his help came with a price. He told Sexton at the very beginning of the conversation that he wasn't just going to give Sexton everything he knew about Bob. He wanted to make a trade. He would share information if Trooper Sexton gave him the description of the man that Margaret O'Brien had seen Sharon arguing with at Auto Center Road. But Ken's bid for this information failed. Sexton told him he had no description, which of course we all know is not true. But hearing that, and likely being relieved to hear it, Ken offered up the information on Bob that he had. Before the interview ended, Sexton circled back to the P.O. Box key that had gotten his attention the last time he'd spoken to Ken. Why did he have a P.O. Box? And furthermore, why was the P.O. Box in the town of Penacook, over 20 minutes away? Ken responded that they had been getting other people's mail and not receiving their own mail, so he decided to get a P.O. Box back in March or April. There weren't any P.O. Boxes available at the time in Bow or Concord, the next town over, so he had to go as far as Penacook to get one. Finally, Ken told Sexton that he would drive by the house in Merrimack that Bob had given him the key to and get the address so the police could check the story out. And the next day, he did.
Oftentimes, when an innocent person ends up in prison for a crime they didn't commit, it's because there was some misconduct by investigators, or because the investigation wasn't thorough, or because of sheer incompetence. But with the exception of one big oversight, failing to search the Johnsons' house and property for evidence, the initial investigation suffered from none of these failures. The case file is huge, and that's because the investigators did everything possible to verify nearly everything that Ken was telling them. Trooper Thomas Sexton himself took the lead on getting to the bottom of the P.O. Box story and visited the main branch of the post office. Sexton learned that Ken Johnson had taken out the box on March 3, 1988 and paid for a year. The box was in his name only and didn't have Sharon's name on it. Sexton then spoke to the Johnsons' mail carrier, who told them she had never gotten a single complaint about misdelivered or missing mail. The carrier was surprised to learn that Ken had taken out a P.O. box because first, the Johnsons continued to get their regular mail, like bills and letters, at the home every day. And second, because it wasn't uncommon for carriers to be given P.O. box mail when the name of the piece of mail was a part of a regular route. But it had never happened to her. She'd never seen any mail for Ken that was intended for a P.O. box. Sexton wasn't done, though. He next checked to see if there was indeed a P.O. box shortage in Ken's area that forced him to get a box over 20 minutes away. Turned out, no surprise, that Ken wasn't telling the truth. In March of 1988, there were exactly 7 vacant P.O. boxes in the Bow post office. Next, the police went to the Merrimack address that Ken provided them to check out the house that the key that Ken gave them allegedly belonged to. Turned out that Ken was actually telling the truth about the key. It did indeed belong to the very house that he pointed them to. That, though, was where the truth ended. The house belonged to a man named Richard Wallace, who had bought the house directly from the builder. Wallace told the police the house had actually never been up for sale, because it was a direct purchase. There had never been any realtor involved, including anyone named Bob. When the police tried the key on the house, it opened the front door as well as both garage doors. Wallace explained that all the doors in the house were keyed the same, so one key could open up all the doors. There had been 8 keys in total, and Wallace was fairly certain he could account for all of them. However, They'd always kept one key under the front steps for contractors to use during construction. The key that Ken provided had a C engraved on it, indicating it was a copy. But Wallace didn't recall any copies being made. When shown a photograph of Ken, he said he'd never seen the man before. When the police checked with the builder of the house, David Moran, as to whether a Ken Johnson could have been one of the subcontractors, he said no. Moran didn't know anyone by that name, and no one by that name had worked in the house or any of his other properties. He also confirmed that no agent had ever shown the house, much less any agent named Bob. Moran confirmed that they had 8 original keys and no copies were made ever. But yes, one key was left under a mat during construction, a common practice that subcontractors could get into and out of the property. You might remember that at the end of episode 3, we mentioned the police interviewed a woman named Mary Lou Farah and her boyfriend Buddy Ballew. Though these interviews came a year after the murder. In his interview, Buddy told the police that he remembered Ken once asking him for a ride, not long after the murder, to look at a house in Merrimack. A house, Ken said, that he and Sharon had been considering buying. The police never asked Buddy to identify the property or to find out what they did when they got there. And when we went looking for Buddy, we unfortunately learned that he is now deceased. So we'll never know if that was a trip that Ken took to grab a key from under a mat, a key he would then make a copy of and give to the police, but the timing of it would all fit.
That lead was now tied into a neat bow, and the police next focused on finding the man that Ken alleged to have placed Bob's bets to, a man named Craig Maxfield. Officer Timothy Pickle met with Maxfield to both verify Ken's story and to determine where Craig Maxfield was on the night of the murder. According to Maxfield, he was working on July 28th, then swung by his mother's around 4:30 to pick up his paycheck, which he then went to cash. After cashing it in, he went to a bar and stayed there until a little after 8 p.m. Finally, that night, he went to the softball park where his team, the Sullivan News, was playing a game at 9. His girlfriend met him at the park with his uniform and stayed to watch the game. Maxfield gave Pickle 3 names to check with and confirmed that he'd been there that night. After the game, around 11 p.m., Maxfield headed to his girlfriend's place and stayed there the rest of the night. Then, they got down to business about Ken and Bob. Yes, said Maxfield, he had heard about Bob. But he hadn't taken any bets through Ken for this Bob guy at all. Rather, Ken had told Maxfield that someone he knew named Bob had lost between $30,000 and $40,000 on some other bookie the prior December. This was around the same time that Ken himself had lost money on college bowl games and owed Maxfield between $5,000 and $6,000 for those bets. At this point, it seems the police still thought there might be something to the Bob story, and so Sergeant Donald Eaton returned to Ken again to get more information and have a composite sketch made. Eaton doesn't tell Ken what Craig Maxfield said about knowing nothing about Bob, and Ken predictably changes his Bob story once again. This time, Ken says that Bob had been winning bets up until last December, and then he placed one large bet that he lost. The money that Ken still owed Craig. When the officer asked Ken how he could place such a large bet for someone he knows nothing about and without taking any money up front, Ken began weeping. Through tears, he told the officer that was how gamblers are. They're weak and will bet on anything that looks good to them. Plus, Ken stood to gain a commission from the winnings, but they never materialized. The last time Ken had spoken to Trooper Sexton, he told him that Bob had shown Sharon and Ken the house in Merrimack. This time, Ken told Sergeant Eaton that Sharon had never met or spoken to Bob. Eaton ends his report with the following. After talking with Johnson in person, this writer feels he is being less than truthful and could give a lot more information concerning the Bob in question, if indeed this person exists at all. This is where the police work gets truly impressive. Despite all signs pointing to the likelihood that there is no Bob at all, the investigators track down every Bob possible with any direct or indirect connection to the Johnsons. They check real estate agencies looking for Roberts and Bobs and speak to everyone they find. None of them check out. They check construction companies for a Bob that fits the description and has ties to Ken and come up empty. Robert Saborin, Robert O'Connell, Robert Harrington, Robert Caffell, Robert Grant, Robert Wilson, Robert Hall. The list of potential Bobs that the police checked out goes on. Investigators put the composite of Bob that Ken helped them create into the New Hampshire Realtor News, the official publication of the New Hampshire Association of Realtors, and also in local papers. Nada. The police reached out to Sharon's family for help, and her brothers provided the name of a Robert they knew who worked in real estate. But that, too, was a dead end. The search for Bob was exhaustive. The police left no stone unturned, and a frankly remarkable show of faith in Ken's statements, even though Ken had miserably failed 2 polygraphs. The examination began with a pre-interview in which Ken recounted what they did the day Sharon was murdered. As always, there were slight variations in his story from previous stories, and Ken was asked only 2 variations of the same question in the polygraph exam itself. Question 1. Did you inflict the injuries that resulted in the death of your wife Sharon? Question 2. Regarding the death of your wife Sharon, did you inflict the injuries that caused it? Ken responded no to both questions. Then the examiner gave Ken a second test, this time with 3 questions. Question 1. Did Ken get the strongbox key before July of 1988? Question 2. Did Ken meet Sharon on the day she was murdered any time after 3 p.m.? And question 3. Did Ken know Bob's last name? Again, Ken answered no to all 3 questions. At the end of the polygraph, the examiner concluded, Mr. Johnson was deceptive when answering the relevant questions.
Ken's web of lies grew and grew in the weeks after Sharon's murder, and only got more tangled when Bob came into the story. He wove multiple false stories about Bob, leading police on a wild goose chase searching for this character for months, while also creating more muddy footprints of his own to be cleaned up. So why did he do it? It was, if anything, a play gone wrong. See, Ken never mentioned the existence of a person named Bob to the police after Sharon was murdered. It wasn't until his wife's co-worker, Sharon Ross, mentioned it to investigators that Ken was forced to face this information that the police now had. And face it, he did, by turning it into an opportunity to put the police on Bob's trail and deflect from himself. Ken even began telling friends like Robert and Lucy Holt that someone named Bob had killed Sharon.
He said that somebody named Bob probably did it. My husband's name is Robert, and he never, ever went by Bob. And it just floored me that he would just pick this name out of thin air and just say, oh, Bob did it. He accused Bob of taking it out on Sharon. Yeah, oh, Bob did it. Yeah.
The investigative trail, however, circled right back to Ken and stopped there. Whether or not Bob actually existed, Sharon Johnson believed he did, and she could have only believed so because her husband told her so. Sharon told multiple people about a Bob that owed Ken money, including her sister-in-law, Diane Eaton. Diane told the police that less than 2 weeks before she was murdered, Sharon had told her that some guy owed Ken $4,000. And around the same time, Sharon also told her brother, Diane's husband, that if she ever found out that Ken was gambling again, she would throw him right out. It's hard to know if Sharon completely trusted Ken's stories about Bob or if she just hoped that it all wasn't a big lie. But given what she told her brother, it's clear that she thought there was a possibility Ken was lying about whether or not he was still gambling. She couldn't totally trust him there. And the police came to the same conclusion, that Ken Johnson couldn't be trusted. Every muddy footprint led them right back to Ken. And yet, from here, the case hung a hard left in a direction that no one could have predicted. Next time on Undisclosed. If you have any information related to this or any of the cases we cover, remember you can reach us on our phone line at 410-205-5563. Once again, that's 410-205-5563. As always, a big thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and of course to Mithil Thelhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant Jennifer Leahy and her mom, and homicide investigator Sarah Kalin, who spent way too long in a car with me driving around New Hampshire.
The police have not found any connection between Ken and this. But let's say that Ken knew somebody who was working on it. Mm-hmm. Why would that person give Ken a key?
Maybe they didn't. Maybe he took it. Maybe it was laying around. You know, I mean, they're...
Ken also had a post office box in a different town that only had his name on it. That apparently Sharon didn't know about when the police asked him about it. He was like, well, they're like, why'd you get a post office box in a different town?
Yeah.
And he said, well,
and you're going right about half a mile.
Okay. He said, well, Bo didn't have any boxes available. Mm-hmm. And
I find that difficult to believe.
Well, like I said, these cops did a great job.
Okay.
They went and they're like, tell us exactly how many boxes were available in this time frame.
Oh, okay, good.
And there were like 7 available.
Oh, okay. So yeah.
And they're like, one is still available, in fact, if you'd like. And he said that, you know, I did it because we were missing mail and blah, blah, blah. They spoke to the mail carrier. She's like, never. She's like, never.
No, there was stuff coming in that he didn't want her to see.
So what do you think it was?
Not quite here. Oh, yeah, you can go straight. You're okay. I mean,
he got in April, and she was called in July. What could he be getting in the mail?
The things that spring to mind when thinking about an intimate partner violence murder would be an extramarital affair.
Right, that's what I was
thinking. So communication. The other thing is if he was taking out a life insurance policy on her and didn't want it coming to the house.
Well, there was a life.
But I know that you're right. Yeah. There were no secret ones that we know.
And
of,
the thing
correct.
Is, she was at work all day, and he didn't work most of the time.
Like, yeah,
he
but
barely
you,
worked. So if he was having an affair, mm-hmm. he just called the house.
And okay, maybe meet up with, yeah. maybe they did do that, but if, you're not going to take that chance. What if
would
she's home
be,
sick when the mail comes and there's you
right?
Know,
could there be anything? Could there be anything connected to his gambling that would have mm-hmm. been in the mail?
I would imagine.
Like
I mean,
what?
I don't know. I'm not.
I know nothing
I'm
about
not
gambling.
I'm not. Yeah, nor do I. But
yeah, I really want to know what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
My daughter, the one I
spoke, we came in this way, so
the one I spoke to yesterday, she's doing better.
Oh, good.
Late last night, I talked to her. She's doing better. So
they finally get her pain meds.
Yes, and poor she's kid. A chipmunk. She's normal. Oh, however, so she is. Her friend is getting engaged next week in Alabama.
There's a lot going on in Alabama lately.
Yeah, she's getting engaged in Alabama, and wait a minute, is Alabama touch the Tennessee line?
Yes.
Okay, so somewhere in that area, and she was gonna fly out, but now she's gonna drive out, and I'm like, I don't want you to.
Turn right here.
First of all, she looks like she's 12, even though she's like 24.
Yeah.
She's tiny, and she's gonna go with another friend. But I'm like, you're still two brown girls.
Yeah. Driving.
Right in an area where you're probably gonna lose signal at some point.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be dark when you get there because you're gonna leave after work. She's like, you're freaking out for no reason, Mama. I'm like, oh, I think I have lots of reason to freak out.
I think you have a reason to freak out because she lives in D.C. She doesn't have the same
frame of reference.
I don't think she's ever been to, she has grown up in the, on the Beltway. She has no idea, like,
what real America is like.
Yeah, she really doesn't. She's never been out there. So I'm like, well, we had a long, gentle argument about it last night. I was like, can you do the fly?
I mean, it would be a fun trip for her and friend, but...
And I would be fine if it was in the daytime. I just don't want her on a back road at 10 p.m. at night with no signal.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and I was like, okay, you got to print up everything. Make sure you have hard copies of your directions so you don't rely on your phone. Blah, blah. So, I mean, there's only so much you can do with a 24-year-old. Yeah.
She's going to do what she's going
to
do.
I'm listening to too much true crime.
Yeah.
You know, how many young women have, like, disappeared on cross-country trips? So many. Maybe I'll ride with her. Maybe, like, I'm coming with you.
Oh, my God. And then she's going to be like, just forget it. I'll fly. I don't want my mother going on an engagement trip with me.